May it please the court, this is an appeal from a summary judgment dismissal of a cause of action that was filed, of course, in the Superior Court. The facts are not really controlling, but just to give you background, basically. The background is that on December 20, 2005, at 4:52 a.m., there was a fire at Mr. and Mrs. Brown's home, and they, of course, called the fire engine, and they were there rather quickly. But when they got there, they, of course, immediately went to the closest fire hydrant, and they tried to open it, but they were not able to open it. Turns out that they apparently were turning the valve the wrong direction. These fire hydrants have directional valves on top of on the very top, so it shows you how to turn it. And it's important because the there's no uniformity in Delaware as to how these things turn. Some turn clockwise, some turn counterclockwise. But unfortunately, this particular fire hydrant had been, the directional arrow had been painted over after years of painting and painting and painting, so that, without regard to the arrow, so that it was covered and could not be seen. They then went to another hydrant a little further down, and they could not turn that hydrant at all. They were just unable to turn it on. Again, the facts indicated afterwards that this hydrant needed nothing more than lubrication, but it had not been lubricated for at least 2 years, even though their inspection and their maintenance requirement and their inspection noted that it was very hard to open, but they had just failed to lubricate it. And they are required by the Public Service Commission to inspect these fire hydrants at least once a year. United testified their CEO.
Mr. Romano, my understanding is this is a summary judgment decision.
Exactly.
So the facts are in no material way in dispute.
Exactly.
So where did the trial judge get the law wrong?
Well, this issue is probably an issue of first impression in this court. There are two cases that seem to be applicable, but they really are not, in my opinion at least, not really in point. The issue before you is the law of the state. Does the law of the state grant absolute immunity, absolute and complete immunity, to a water company because they insert in their tariff that they file with the Public Service Commission immunity for damage if they don't provide the adequate water or don't take care of their equipment? That's the law, and that's the issue before you. There is nothing in Delaware law that says that. There is no statute. They have not, no case. There's two cases that I will discuss in a minute, but there are no cases exactly on point that say that.
Well, before we get to the cases, can you explain to us the legal significance of the term tariff rate and filed rate doctrine? Are those two distinct concepts in the law, and what do they mean?
My understanding is that the tariff and the filed doctrine is that the tariff essentially is a contract with Public Service Commission, or an expression of what you're going to do. You file with the Public Service Commission, they then have a hearing, and they approve your rates and approve this tariff that you present them as to what you're going to do.
Well, does the filed rate doctrine mean anything more than a customer cannot challenge the rate that the customer has to pay because it's set by a regulatory body whose decision in that regard is tantamount to a statute? Does it mean anything more than that?
In my opinion, it does not. In my opinion, all it means is exactly that. But this doctrine of immunity had its inception many, many years ago, probably in the 1920s, in the federal system, where Congress passed interstate commerce laws and interstate commission and communication laws and so forth. And in the federal system, the doctrine that grants you immunity is a fact. I mean, that's the law of the federal government, and the Supreme Court has so stated.
Well, any immunity that the water company has would be defined by its tariff or contract, right? It doesn't come out of the Delaware Constitution or from the common law. It's defined by their tariff or contract, correct?
That's what they're relying on, yes.
Right. Paragraph 41 of the tariff says, the company will not be liable for any claim or damage arising from a shortage of water, breaking of machinery or other facilities, or any other cause beyond its control. Do the facts here establish that the cause was beyond the company's control? Or did the company have an obligation to maintain these hydrants?
The company had an obligation to maintain these items. They were to maintain them. They're required to at least inspect them once a year. They inspect them twice a year. And they're required to maintain them. This was clearly not beyond their control.
All right, so even if there's some common law immunity doctrine or judge-made law immunity doctrine, it's the tariff that controls their responsibility, correct? That's the contract they agreed to.
That's the contract they agreed to. Of course, you know, they were relying on a different section which doesn't talk about beyond their control. But that which Rana read is correct reading, and it's in that tariff. But the
Mr. Romano, yes. Excuse me, just so I at least will understand where your argument is heading. You know, the three options here, one is absolute immunity, and you know, we know you don't agree with that.
Right.
Then there's no immunity. And then there's qualified immunity. Which of the latter two do you contend should be the outcome here?
I contend there should be no immunity at all, because I don't think the law in Delaware requires that, and it is completely illogical and has no factual or logical support. I mean, if it had support 50 years ago or 70 years ago, it has no support today. And the reason, frankly, why it has no support is because, even assuming that there's some legitimacy in trying to avoid discrimination or discriminatory rates and so forth, this is only applies to the water company having inadequate pipes or not providing water and so forth. It does not exempt them from liability, for example, for a slip and fall. Somebody comes to their office and they slip and fall, they get sued like everybody else. If their truck driver has gone to the fire hydrant to maintain it and goes for a stop sign, they get sued. Now, what's the logic? I mean, when they get sued, then obviously their rates may increase, although in reality they have insurance. In this case, they got $3 million worth of insurance. But
Mr. Romano, in Delaware, water is supplied by private companies such as the defendant here, correct?
Right.
By municipalities?
Yes.
Are those the only two options? Or perhaps sewer and water authorities, I guess, which is some hybrid type of entity. But as it stands now, if we uphold the ruling of the Superior Court, are there going to be different rules for different entities? In other words, is a municipality, they don't file with the PSC, right?
I don't believe so.
So there's no tariff.
I believe Your Honor is correct.
For a municipality, what is there, the Tort Claims Act?
Right, that's the only protection would be Municipal Tort Claim Act that may preclude them or may not preclude them. It depends on how you view this.
The Superior Court's analysis, extending it to the situation with the municipality could be liable, but a private water company would not.
Yes, exactly, unless the municipality was immune because of their Torts Claim Act.
Right.
But that would not allow immunity for gross negligence or willful and wanton conduct.
Nor for when insurance is available.
Nor when insurance is available, yes. Exactly.
Just a small point of order here. In terms of gross negligence or willful and wanton conduct, is it your contention that your complaint alleges either of those states?
Absolutely. The words gross negligence, quote, are not in my complaint. But willful and wanton and reckless conduct and intentional conduct are there very clearly. I mean, I can read it.
Okay, that's fine.
You mentioned the other paragraph in the tariff that your colleagues rely on. That's paragraph 49.
Correct.
Can you contrast with us how one reads in paramateria paragraphs 41 and 49 and come to some understanding about what limitation there is on the liability of United, if any?
If you're asking me to compare it, the 49 deals with the fire protection only. 46 deals in general. Our argument is that it makes no sense to have liability only if it's beyond your control, which of course in this case was not, but to have absolute liability when it deals with fire protection. I mean, frankly, you would think it would be the reverse, since fire protection is such a serious and devastating thing to a community. But I don't know. I mean, there's no logic as to why they have 46 beyond control and 49 absolute if it's fire protection.
Mr. Romano, is the effect of your contention, if we were to uphold it, basically to strike from the tariff any disclaimers of liability? Or I should say any proclamations of immunity from liability.
Strike it, or simply hold it. It's not absolute immunity. It's not binding on the courts. Okay. And as Rehnquist, by the way, said in that Supreme Court opinion, he said this should not preclude, not be used as a shield for state law, for any violation of the state law.
Right.
So the Supreme Court decision has nothing to do with the state law.
Okay. I didn't know whether your position would have us give effect to some immunity provisions in the tariff, but not others. Your position is absolute.
My position is,
no
is
effect,
that,
right.
that you should be treated like anybody else and liable for your negligence.
Well, let's assume that this limitation on liability, in whatever form, was bargained for. As I understand the case law in other jurisdictions, they recognize the tariff's limitation on ordinary negligence, but they don't recognize the tariff to limit liability for gross negligence, willful and wanton, reckless, or intentional conduct. Is that part of your argument?
Well, my argument, of course, is that they should be liable like anybody else for negligence. If the court does
you're
not...
You're talking ordinary negligence.
Ordinary negligence. But if the court does not rule that way or accept that argument, then absolutely, they at least should be liable for gross negligence or willful and wanton conduct.
And at that point, what, we would have to remand and ask the court to determine whether you've adequately alleged gross negligence and willful and wanton?
Yeah, I don't think there's any frankly, issue that I allege that, because it clearly says willful and wanton conduct. What the issue would be whether there was enough evidence in the record for a jury to find that there was gross negligence or willful and wanton conduct, which, frankly, is in most cases, and certainly in this one, a jury question, because not abiding by the commission's rules and maintaining it for years and years, and one instance in 2 years in a row at least, another instance, has to indicate or can indicate an I don't care attitude.
Well, you have to have facts pleaded as well, don't you, to support willful and wanton or gross negligence or reckless conduct?
Well,
you can't just say failure to keep a proper lookout and therefore acted willfully and wantonly.
Well, I think the facts are pled. I mean,
have facts in the complaint support
that allegation. And the facts that were discovered in discovery certainly support. Of course, they were not an issue in the court system because that was not brought up as an issue. So they were not presented to the Superior Court. Proximate cause was, and incidentally, the appellee does seem to argue approximate cause, but again, that really is not an issue before Your Honor at this time.
I'd just like to explore the merits of your argument. I mean, the shorthand up for your argument is that this doctrine makes no sense. It's arbitrary.
Exactly.
Is that a shorthand for saying that it doesn't bear any relationship to the policy or policies that justified the doctrine in the first place? And if that's the case, then can you elaborate?
Yeah, it does not. And also, of course, there's no law that says it does. There's no legislative law, no statute, or case law. But the reason why it was adopted, as the Supreme Court says, is to avoid discrimination between the different water companies, but but the interstate commerce companies and different companies, so that when they said, when the government said, commission said, Interstate Commerce Commission said, you're going to charge $10 for every phone, whatever it was, then that was a charge, and it could be no different, there could be no change, it was strictly enforced. Now, the two fallacies. First, today, with deregulation, I mean, there's competition all over the place. I don't know why that has any bearing. But the second argument, which I think is just as important, is the fact that if you want to do that, you could do that two ways. First, you could say, all right, all water companies in this instance would be liable for if they don't take care of their equipment. Therefore, of course, there is no discrimination because they're liable. But also, it makes no sense because that's not where the liability comes from. The liability, not the only place liability comes from other things, like a fall, auto accidents, and maybe a slew of other things. So since they're not included in there, what's the logic of including only fire protection in there? I mean, how does that help you with avoiding discrimination or different rates? And then finally, frankly, if that was a problem, you could always go back to the Public Service Commission and say, well, we had a horrible year this year. We had, you know, all these judgments against us. Of course, there's insurance again. So maybe we need to increase the rates. So that could be a way to cure that if that was really there. But it's not there legally. It's not there factually. It's not there logically. It's just not there.
You're in your rebuttal time. I'm sorry.
Are there similar immunities for electric companies, to your knowledge?
I'm not sure about electric companies. I know that, for example, other states, like that Herbert decision in New Jersey by the gas company, that where there was an explosion, and the court said you're liable regardless. That was gas, but that was in New Jersey. I would assume there'd be some in Delaware, but I'm not positive.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save the balance?
Yeah, I'll save. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. Sean Ballou of Ballard Spahr on behalf of the defendant below, appellee, United Water Delaware, Inc. And with me at counsel table is my colleague, David Felice. Your Honor, and the Court, my argument today will take two focuses. I want to first focus on the posture of the case before you in terms of what is the issue that you need to determine, and that's going to be stem from Justice Berger's question about what was pled and what was decided below. Essentially, we think that there's a very narrow issue here, and we want to make sure that that's presented appropriately through the pleading stage, through the briefing on the motion for summary judgment. After we cast the issue properly, the second line of argument we want to address with the Court is the applicability of the filed rate doctrine to the precise issue, which we believe is this. This is not a question of absolute immunity. This is a question of whether the filed rate doctrine or the filed tariff doctrine precludes a case of negligence under Delaware law. And it doesn't need to go further than that. The complaint below made no reference whatsoever to gross negligence. There is language in the complaint that deals with allegations of willfulness and wantonness, especially in connection with the claims related to intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Was Mr. Romano correct when he said that what discovery was taken gathered facts that would support a claim for gross negligence?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. And this is why you do not see.
Should he be allowed if we disagree with the application of law in this case that resulted in summary judgment being granted to your client, if we were to remand it, should we allow him to replead based on what was discovered?
Well, no, Your Honor, because we're not even relying on the complaint. We can move past the complaint and give plaintiffs the benefit of the doubt at the pleading stage.
Well, I thought that was your first argument.
Well,
and that it was inextricably linked to your contention that ordinary negligence is barred by the tariff doctrine.
The argument goes into progression, Your Honor. The complaint on its face has one subparagraph that references willful and wanton. There's no reference in the complaint to gross negligence. If we look past that inadequacy in the pleading, we did go through a tremendous amount of discovery. And what was discovered in the case? It was discovered that there were two hydrants that were at issue. The first hydrant, there's no dispute that two paramedics turned the hydrant the wrong way. The hydrants in the state and across the country, some turn clockwise, some counterclockwise. It's just a manufacturing issue. The issue with the first hydrant, which was discovered, was an allegation of it wasn't properly marked, a failure to instruct on the top of the hydrant on which way to turn the hydrant. That's the allegation of negligence. Now, we dispute that. We dispute that issue, but even capturing that issue as the first hydrant, we don't think that, as a matter of law, that could rise even to the level of gross negligence. So that's the first hydrant. Now we moved to the second hydrant. What was discovered about the second hydrant? For whatever reason, and I mean, we have our theory that if the case were ever tried, we would obviously proffer. There's no explanation why they couldn't get the second hydrant to open. We suspect that they were turning it the wrong way. They turned the first hydrant the wrong way, and it became the freewheel. So they broke it. The second one, we believe they were turning the wrong way as well. Now, discovery also showed, as to the second hydrant, that in 2004 it was inspected, and there was a notation made in the inspection that said it was hard to open, very hard to open, quote, very hard to open in November of 2004. In April of 2005, it was found to be hard to open. So there are the facts in the best light possible for the plaintiffs in this case. And we think not only now the plaintiffs had an opportunity to present those issues to the trial court, to Judge Parkins. They had an opportunity to create a genuine issue of material fact as to whether those set of circumstances rose to the level of gross negligence. They did not do that. The plaintiffs did not do that. If you look at the briefing, our motion for summary judgment on behalf of United Water sets out the file tariff doctrine as barring the claim. Now, we were basing it on the fact that the complaint didn't say gross negligence. Nobody prosecuted a claim for gross negligence. It was never even entertained throughout the litigation. We have a response to that motion for summary judgment that makes conclusory references, and this is in the response briefing on the summary judgment at pages 4 to 6, is the first time we see anything even noting gross negligence, and it's used it for the first time in response. Well, that's not sufficient to carry the burden of creating a material issue of fact. If there was an issue of fact that should have been raised at that point, it would have had to have been done for the benefit of Judge Parkins to make that decision, to see whether there is a genuine issue of material fact. In Judge Parkins' decision, you look at page 1 and page 3, he frames the issue. And to paraphrase, he said this is a claim for negligence. He says it twice. There's never any reference to gross negligence, and there's a reason why. That's because the plaintiffs never asserted it. It wasn't clear in the complaint at best, and we believe that it was never briefed, that there was no genuine issue of material fact created. So that frames the issue in our minds, Your Honors. This is an issue of whether they can push forward with a claim on simple negligence. And we think the case law is very supportive of Judge Parkin's decision, as well as public policy's way in favor of affirming the lower court's decision. Let's start with the tariff language. And let's take a step back. Let's take a look at what the tariff is. The tariff is a contract.
Clear up for me first. Is there a distinction between the filed tariff and the filed rate doctrine that's relevant here?
No, Your Honor. We don't believe there is.
We're really talking about the filed tariff in its terms, aren't we?
Well, I think that the filed tariff doctrine is a better way to call it, because the filed rate, especially for our position, the filed rate doctrine seems to limit it to rates.
Right.
But the tariff gives it the more comprehensive view that this is more encompassing than rates.
That's why I asked the question. It's, if you read even something as basic as Amgur, the filed rate doctrine would have no bearing on the issue here because it only goes to challenging the rates that are set. So we're talking about the file tariff in this particular relationship between United and Delaware.
Yes, we think a refined definition would be the filed tariff doctrine. And to get to that point, Your Honor, I think Vice Chancellor Seitz captured this issue the best that could it be captured in the 1950 Supreme Court decision. He was sitting by designation. And this isn't just about rates. All right, it's about a tariff. It's about a contract between the citizenry of the state of Delaware and the state through the regulatory body of the Public Service Commission. And quoting Vice Chancellor Seitz in the Western Union v. Abbott case, he states that the theory is this, and this is the whole theory behind the filed tariff doctrine. Since it renders a service, meaning the utility, affecting the public, the state shall regulate and control it in order to prevent injustice. So that's the injustice about discriminatory rates.
But let me stop you there for a minute. We're talking about the abolition of responsibility for negligent conduct by the utility. It's one thing if the state legislature enacts a statute that abolishes liability for simple negligence. The question that I have is, where does the Public Service Commission get its authority to do that, to abolish common law liability?
Well, Your Honor,
where in the Constitution or in any statute does the PSC get that power simply by approving a tariff, which is more likely than not drafted by the utility to serve its own interests?
Your Honor, 26 Delaware Code, Section 201 and Section 301, which are quoted in the lower court's opinion, deal with the Public Service Commission's jurisdiction over utilities, and it also goes on to talk about how the Public Service Commission has an ability to regulate rates and set rates. There is no line.
What does that have to do with abolishing a citizen's right to sue the utility for, let us assume, negligently inflicted injury, which is the fault of the utility?
Well, Your Honor, getting back to the quotation, the rates and the limit of liability are inextricably tied together. They run hand in hand. And it's in consideration of the ability of the Public Service Commission to limit the rates that the quid pro quo or the equilibrium that follows is the limit of liability.
Well, the liability, which in most cases is covered by insurance, may or may not have an impact on the rate. And let's assume we have a case where it doesn't. The liability would still be foreclosed under the filed rate doctrine. In that case, it's totally untethered to the rationale for the doctrine itself.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. Borrowing from Vice Chancellor Seitz's analysis in the Abbott case, there's no disconnect between the setting of the rate and the limitation of liability. The issue of insurance, the issue of whether there would be runaway lawsuits, the issues of all these public policy concerns, they're in the case law. You see them in Weinberg. You see them in other cases. But the fact of the matter is it's the Public Service Commission that is best vested to make those policy decisions. They've been empowered by the General Assembly to set the rates.
Under your view of the law, the Public Service Commission could approve a tariff with a utility that immunizes the utility from any liability to any private citizen. Isn't that correct?
That is not our position, Your Honor. There is always the check that is clear in the majority rule that if some immunity is against public policy, that it can be stricken down. If it's unreasonable, there's a reasonable standard that's throughout the case law. But
subject only to that, there would be expansive implied authority of the Public Service Commission to create broad immunity against any form of liability if it were so inclined. And it could do it simply by contract. Correct?
Yes. I would qualify that, Your Honor, with one proviso. This body continuously, by its duty, reviews the acts of the General Assembly, including those acts that empower regulatory agencies, under various standards. Reasonableness is a very, very low threshold. So, in our minds. So it would have to be reasonable. And we think that's the ultimate check as to how the regulatory scheme works. The General Assembly has empowered the Public Service Commission, five citizens of the state of Delaware, to deal with these issues. The expectation is those five individuals will be practiced in the areas of utilities, and they will understand these issues on a more micro level than perhaps the General Assembly and, of course, others.
So your response is, trust me, or trust them.
Trust but verify, I guess, Your Honor. I mean, I think there is a check. There's an inherent check in the system in that there's the reasonableness check, and then there's also the check that if, you know, I'm happy to see the Browns in the courtroom today, that they survived this fire and everybody was safe. If the citizens that elect the General Assembly aren't happy with the amount of power that they've given to the Public Service Commission, there's a way to remedy that.
Now, where is it in the statute that the General Assembly has conferred upon the PSC the authority to grant immunity of any kind?
It's not there, Your Honor.
Well, there may be good reasons for it, but why isn't that the province exclusively of the General Assembly to do it by specific legislation?
Your Honor, the rationale that is set out in the case law explaining the justification, again, talks about, again, this is the Abbott case and also in the Wolschen case. There's a direct correlation between rate setting and limiting liability.
Well, you've said that several times, but today you can get insurance for everything. And it would seem that you would just insure all of your possible exposures. Your insurance premium would be something that you would factor into the rate, and that would take care of it. Why, when you can quantify the amount of your insurance premium, and you can insure against any possible risk, shouldn't that be determinative?
First and foremost, John, the insurance that's in place here, just so the record's clear, there's a self-insured retention. This money is actually coming from United
Water
Delaware.
That's a
separate issue.
My question is public policy. If your whole argument is tied to the rate, and we need to be able to identify our costs, and if we're going to have to pay out claims to a lot of people, we're going to have these surprises that will be budget breakers, we just can't run our company that way. And my question is, why isn't the answer to insure against the risks, put the premium in your rate application, and that takes care of it?
Your Honor, my two points. The first answer is that may be the answer. And if it is the answer that controls, it's an answer that should be arrived at by the Public Service Commission, who can have the hearings and determine that that's the right way to capture the risk. Also, I think it's not simply an ability to buy insurance. Regardless of how you capture the added expense, whether it's additional insurance premium or payment of lawsuits, it does have an effect on the way that a utility can plan its business. And unlike other unregulated companies that can get insurance, they can pass that premium on freely to their customers, whereas here there's not that ability to operate in a free market where they can change rates at any given time. So that there is a difference.
Well, but you would expect, would you not, if the Public Service Commission determined that rather than approve tariff language that is cited at page 6 of the Superior Court's opinion, which I understand to be, though it's not cited to it, paragraph 49 of the tariff, which purports to exclude all claims for injury to persons or property by reason of failure to supply water pressure or capacity, that the Public Service Commission would recognize if they expanded liability, there would be a cost for that, and it would be reflected in the tariff.
If they chose to do it that way, Your Honor, they could. But what they've done is they've done it in a different fashion. And that's a policy decision that they've made.
Well, help me understand then. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, you're correct on that, that it's a cost-benefit analysis that the Public Service Commission, who's capable of determining legislative facts and has been delegated that authority by the General Assembly, can better decide that than this court, the relative relationship between the cost of water supply and the ability to sue when you're injured by a failure of that supply because of fire. How do we read together paragraph 41, which says the company will not be liable for any claim or damage arising from a shorter of water, breaking of machinery, or any other cause beyond its control, with what's cited on page 6, which says free and exempt from any and all claims
Your Honor,
injury related to failure to supply water? Why are those terms different?
Well, in terms of this sui generis question presented to Mr. Ramon, I anticipated that question. Obviously, the fire provision is more specific. It deals with precisely the issue we're dealing here. I'm talking about paragraph 49 of the tariff.
That's the one on page 6.
Right, that's the easy one. Now, the paragraph 41, Your Honor, we believe that that needs to be qualified by any other cause beyond its control. So you're talking about a shortage of water if it doesn't rain a sufficient amount, the breaking of machinery, something that for some reason a piece of machinery breaks.
But that's a factual issue, isn't it, whether it was under their control or not, if that's the one that applies? For example, if one of the reasons that the hydrant didn't operate at the time of the fire was because some nitwit painted over the directions over time and no one inspected and checked that, and that's why they got it wrong, or because the hydrant was manufactured in such a way that if you turned it the wrong way, with or without proper instructions, it would freewheel, and there's no protection against it freewheeling. There's nothing that would indicate to a reasonable person that it didn't work that way, turn it the other way. It just wouldn't break. Are either of those two factual situations beyond the control of the company?
They are, Your Honor. But
isn't it a factual issue for a jury about whether they are or not, if it can be couched in the terms that would be a claim of gross negligence or willful and wanton?
Under the way that the tariff is written, the issues you just described would never get to a jury on simple negligence. On gross negligence, we believe that's an issue for another day. Paragraph 41 wouldn't be triggered by an instance that was related to a fire, necessarily. It's a miscellaneous provision that we would look to that if there was a drought and there was not a sufficient amount of water that could be sent to that hydrant. The breaking of machinery and other facilities is meant to reference not necessarily hydrants, but the broader scope of mechanical equipment that is involved.
Well, it's understandable, for example, if there's an automobile accident and the hydrant's run over and broken, that's beyond the company's control. They can't do anything about it until they can get out there and fix it. I understand breaking machinery in that sense. But if you read that language, and if it applied to fire, and I understand your point that it does not, it certainly could be read reasonably to provide that if the machinery broke under circumstances that were under the company's control or could have been prevented by company's routine maintenance or inspection, then why wouldn't it be a basis for liability?
I think, Your Honor, the reading of the two statutes, the two provisions, actually captures the fact that there's not an absolute immunity. All right? There's immunity within the bounds of public policy when the root cause of the injury is a fire, and that's the more specific term. There's also a carve-out for situations unrelated to fire that deal with situations that were beyond control of the company. For example, a piece
Okay, I take your point to be that my focus should be on paragraph 49 because it's the paragraph that specifically allows the company to be free and exempt from any and all claims, which is not a limitation of just simple negligence, but a limitation of all claims means what it says, by reason of fire. And for that reason, it's the only paragraph that applies.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you help me understand that basically all of this is rooted in an intention of the General Assembly in terms of fixing the rates and setting the rates that this type of immunity is appropriate. Is that right? Why would the General Assembly have different rules if that's their intent for, say, a municipality that supplies water, where we're at the gross negligence level, and a private company, and give them greater immunity? What would be the logic of that?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is following up on your question about the Tort Claims Act earlier. I mean, the Tort Claims Act is a legislatively enacted abrogation of sovereign immunity, and it is done carefully, we would hope, in a way that the General Assembly is trying to balance the needs to limit liability yet provide people protection for tort claims. Now, the insurance for municipalities, maybe the General Assembly believes that the insurance is not going to be an overwhelming cost for municipalities. They think they can get decent rates because of their buying power. Maybe it's just a matter of the municipality is protected by a tax power that it can ultimately pass those costs on through taxes to the general public. Now, does it make sense that there's different standards? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But the fact is that there are different standards. If in fact there's an incident that falls under an exemption to the sovereign immunity as captured in the Tort Claims Act. So it could be different.
Do we have any record, or do you know independently of the record, how common this kind of provision is in a tariff?
Your Honor, it is common in the tariff at issue here, I know, because this tariff has been revised 27 times, and it's survived.
I just mean generally.
I see my time is up, but I'll sum up by saying the exact same language was in the Haney case, which we distinguish from the facts here.
What about other states? Mr. Romano makes the point that Chief Justice Rehnquist said states can do things differently. Do we know what other states are doing?
Based on my discussions, and this is outside the record, Your Honor, with my client who operates in many states across the country, this language is not odd for it or for similar utilities. Thank you.
Just briefly in response, I think it has to be recognized that the lower court very clearly said that this was an absolute immunity. Its holding was very simple. The lower court said in its opinion, the issue is whether limited liability provision in defendant's tariff, which was filed with the Delaware Public Utilities Commission, precludes recovery in this case under the file rate doctrine because a damages award in this case could have the effect of changing defendants' approved rates. Plaintiffs' claims were barred by the file rate doctrine, and therefore defendants' motion is granted. I mean, the court did not look at gross negligence, regular negligence, willful wanton, anything. Court was aware that there was a gross negligence, or at least that it even mentions that there is a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress, which obviously has to be gross and reckless and so forth. But all of those things made no difference. This judge, this decision, says there is a absolute immunity. It doesn't use the word absolute, but that's the effect of it. Just simply says it can change the rates, and therefore there's no liability. It is clear, of course, that all these things were beyond the control of United. For example, the United, the general manager United, admitted at that position that even though they were aware that this fire hydrant 2 years in a row was very hard to open, and what very hard first year, hard to open next year, she admitted they did nothing about it. They did not they did not do anything to repair it, and all they needed was lubrication. So, I mean, it certainly was within their control. It certainly was gross negligence. Certainly was willful and wanton. But that's a jury question. That's up for another day. If Your Honor, of course, the courts, of course, reverses this. So, that's all I have to say.
One last question for me, anyway. How could the trial judge have decided otherwise if he relied on the tariff, and the tariff said free and exempt from any and all claims for injury to persons or property by reason of fire? Any and all claims means any and all claims.
Any and all claims. Once the trial judge decided that this was applicable and controlling, it had no choice, really, if it was going to apply it, to dismiss the case no matter what the facts were.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you.